RadioInfluence.com.
You know her from network radio, but now she's on the net and in your head.
Don't believe me, just watch.
This is the Fabulous Sports Babe on RadioInfluence.com.
Hey, it's me. I'm on the Fabulous Podcast. I have no idea if anybody listens to this, but they just show up and I just do what I'm supposed to do. As long as I don't have to go to work 5 days a week, it's fine with me. That's what I've done. You know what we're doing? I have to tell you something. So I'm looking at football, and I'm really loving football. And, you know, I don't want to say anything, but yes, the Patriots won again. I can't complain. I don't think it's going to happen, though. I don't think the Patriots are going to go all the way, and I don't think that Cam Newton's going all the way. The more I look at it, I'm thinking, I'm not so sure that they're going to go 16-0, but we'll wait and see about that. You know what we're going to do today? We're going to talk to my friend Linda Cohn. I've known Linda Cohn for over 20 years. And she has wonderful stories to tell you. And so we will talk a lot about that and what she has to say. I knew her way back in Seattle, and I've known her since ESPN, and we've just always remained very good friends. And some good thoughts maybe on what you, sometimes what people think happened in radio or television, but it doesn't really happen in that way. And you know what? It is Thanksgiving, so we will talk a little bit about what you have. I don't want to say anything. I got these idiots that are coming to my, they're not to my house. They're somebody else's house. I refuse to have anyone in my house. I don't know 4 people I even want in the house, so I would never have them in. But somehow I have vegans. What is that? You know, what is it? It's just, you're just complaining about crap. So I have to make, like, I make this wonderful curried pumpkin soup, and it's very involved, and I'm lovely, and I got to make a vegan one. So I got to find out if they like almond milk or coconut milk. I hate these people. Can't you? And you got to use vegetable broth. I don't even want to go through all of this. You know who we're going to talk to? We got to talk to Rob Littell. He's pretty good. He's from Black Sports Online. And we start talking to him. We talk a little bit about Missouri and what happened. And then we started talking a little bit about some of the other things at Ferguson. We started talking about that. And then we talked about Cam Newton, whether or not people think that he's a thug. Because what, he dances around? I mean, get over yourself. But what we were talking about is it's really not 90%. It's these 10% that you hear about. And that some woman did call up and said that I never want my 8-year-old son to see him again. And I'm like, shut up, you dumb redneck. Oh, all these things are coming up on my lovely podcast. Is it time now? Yes. So let's go start with my friend Linda Cohn. Linda Cohn, I love you. Let's talk, Linda, about the fact that you've been there. For how long have you been at ESPN? You're like you've been there forever.
Yes, I have. 23 years to me equals forever. And that's how long I've been there. And it's been really awesome because, you know, I've been a part of the major growth of this, the worldwide leader in sports, the changes around me, the changes in technology, the changes in the way SportsCenter is shown. The changes of having like personality stand out and not stand out, you know, you name it. And how, to me, it's the greatest compliment when, you know, young people come up to me and say, you know, I grew up with you, Linda. And to me, that's great. And that I was, you know, a small part of their amazing fabric of life. But that's what ESPN has become. And it's great. So, you know, someday it's like, not that I can compare myself to a professional athlete, but you know, when they look back, sure, and they look back on a career, you know what I'm saying, babe? You know, mm-hmm, you live it. You know what I'm talking about. Until you hang it up, you're not going to really realize just what a ride it was.
You know, one of the things that I talked about when I was thinking about Linda, I thought to myself, I knew you in Seattle, which, by the way, is the best story in the world. But let's go before Seattle. Where were you before you went to Seattle?
Well, I knew I was many stops. Like, I was worked 7 days a week doing radio and little cable TV on Long Island. To do everything I could, babe, to get the most experience, because I knew I wanted to be in sports. So I couldn't be a professional hockey player and be a goalie in the NHL. But I wanted to be a part of what made me feel good. And sports always filled a void for me growing up. I had tremendously low self-esteem. And I knew that as I was getting older and graduated college at Oswego State, I realized I had to do something in sports. If it isn't on the air, it had to be in the business and PR, something. Because it was what drove me, it what kept me excited. I was addicted to that roller coaster life of being a fan first.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can always, you know, tie that into what we do for a living, then it doesn't feel like work. So then I really took that to the next level, doing you know, radio, and like I said, little cable TV on Long Island, and I found myself working 7 days a week until I got my first big break, which was the move to Seattle and working at the CBS affiliate there, being a sports reporter and a weekend sports anchor, and that's where ESPN spotted me.
Well, that's where they spotted me, so they had to go way up there for no reason at all. But you had a different situation than I did. You know what? You got to tell the story. I'm sorry. Tell them about the dome. You're calling me up going, they told me to find the dome. I can't find the dome. The dome is like this big thing in the middle of Seattle. It's the kingdom. And Lynn is going, I can't find the dome. Tell everybody about that.
Right.
It was the best.
Great story, babe. Obviously, there were no GPSs back in the day. I'm sure you're aware. If only I had one. Who in the world cannot find the kingdom? It's like an absolute joke. And by the way, this was like, you're talking to a New York girl here, you know, kind of ventures around New York City and knows where she's going. How can a New York girl go to Seattle and not know her way around? It's not as big as Manhattan, but somehow, some way. But then the kingdom became my home. It became my second home because I found myself always there, and it's, I love it. I mean, babe, you'll get a kick out of this. I went back there just recently, about 2 months ago, with my daughter, Sammy, who was born there. Mm-hmm. And she had not been back. And she's 24 now. And we went together as mom and daughter. And it was fabulous. I just to see the growth of that city. And the kingdom, of course, not there anymore. But I was able to get around because of something called the GPS and Uber cars. So I was okay. I've progressed.
You know, one of the things, I had to laugh when Lynn was going, I can't find the kingdom. I'm like, how hard is that? It's the only thing that's the big thing. In that, Linda, when you decided to go to ESPN, and you mentioned it, think about when you went in there in like 92, 93, whenever you went in there, and how different it is in 2015 compared to what you had at that time. You know, the technology that you're dealing with, so different today than it was then.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the transition for me was going to, first of all, just a national network, and it was just a small core of people. That's number one. You know, it was so small, even though it dealt with national topics and sports nationally, mm-hmm. and you knew everyone that was there. But just, you know, I mean, I always tell this story, which is kind of funny. Actually, I got there in 92, but I think it was around 1994, 95, where the management realized, and you know about this, where they knew that they were going to have to sell the personalities of SportsCenter, and they started making those This is SportsCenter commercials.
Mm-hmm.
And then they realized, you know, that was a big deal to do, and that's what set ESPN and all of us apart, but also set us apart and gave us longevity, was the fact that they allowed our personalities to come out on SportsCenter. Why and how? Well, because we wrote our own copy. We wrote our own stuff for head writers, and that was one way of doing that, and that is the way it is to this day. And the other part of it is the technology around us. What I was going to get at was this talent. We used to have back in the day talent meetings just to get all of us together to talk about changes and things that are going on with the show. And one of the things I remember being in a meeting when they said to us, well, we're going to start this new thing. It's called The Bottom Line. And even though you're going to work really hard on your on-camera 25-second lead-ins to a highlight of the game the night before, we're going to already give people a score on this bottom line. Hey, I'll tell you, babe, you could not believe the uproar and the outrage of some of my colleagues thinking, how can you do that? How can you tell people what happened in the game when I'm about to tell them? Why would they keep watching?
Mm-hmm.
Remarkably, they kept watching. So I always bring up that just to show you something we take for granted now and how we're lost without it now. It was such a talking point, such a big change in the way sports is broadcast. That's one example. So, I mean, the growth is amazing, and what I'm really proud of being associated with that network is the fact that there have been many up-and-comers and the networks trying to, you know, compete, and they just haven't been able to. I mean, it's getting better now for the outside world because I think the changes, babe, that we've seen. And I find it, I'll be honest with you, I'm such a big sports nut and a fan, that I will find myself, if I want to watch hockey or care about what happened in hockey, mm-hmm. I'm going to the NHL Network. I'm not watching sports center.
Right.
If I cared about, which I did, and I was obsessed with my Mets.
With your Mets.
I mean, I knew the MLB Network was going to get the most coverage because they have the better deal that gave them better access so I can see my beloved Mets better. You know what? So I think that's the world we live in now. And that makes the job of ESPN even more challenging to be as valuable as it was back in the day.
Linda, one of the things that, you know, as you said, Daniel now is 19 and Sammy is 24. How did you do that? I mean, because I sometimes look at it and I think, I don't know how the hell you do that. You know, when I've had conversations with other people, but I thought to myself, you were raising these kids while you were doing this. And you know, they can call you at every 5 minutes and you have to go to Bristol, Connecticut. And yet you're raising these kids at the same time, which I thought, you know, back in the days in the 70s, we can do it all. And I'm thinking to myself, I could never do that now.
Yeah, you know, I mean, now it's become very routine for a lot of people. And but, you know, again, like, Sammy's 24, Dan's 19, so, you know, there's so many stories I can share regarding that, you know, I think I got very little sleep, I didn't have a full night's sleep, you know, and I didn't have any nannies, I never did. Now, early on I was married, but, you know, then I got divorced, and then it was a thing where it was really tough emotionally at times because I knew I had to go work mm-hmm. and then missed many things and different things. But I know, babe, it could have always been worse. I could have always been one of those amazing reporters where they're always traveling. And thank goodness my talents and my skills were more anchoring and in the studio. So I knew where I had to be on every day. And you know what? My kids have grown up in independence. And the way they have grown up, I would never change anything because they know how hard their mom works and works for them. And that's all that matters. And they knew, and they know now as well, that I put them first. So that's a great thing. But now when I look around, it's amazing how many women, even in the business, even some at ESPN, who, you know, work, and they work pregnant, just like I did, and mm-hmm. all that. Back when I was pregnant and working at ESPN, you know, guys can make jokes all they want. No one took them in for sexual harassment.
Exactly.
Now, forget about it. All these women are so protected. So no one ever gives them a hard time or anything. So I feel that really, you know, that's where also I have been a pioneer. And that's what I preach to young people as well, especially young women, that they can have everything they want. They can have families and how important balance is and not to be defined just by the network you work for or defined by the fact that you're on TV. Who cares?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You need balance. And that's the one thing. One of the many things really I'm the most proud of when I look back in my career is that I stopped to raise a family and also, you know, made sacrifices in other areas with my job and did not, you know, people say, why did you stay at ESPN for 23 straight years? Well, what's the grass is always greener, right? I mean, I put my kids first. So that, babe, is the thing that I'm most proud of. And I didn't just, you know, run to every opportunity that was available.
You know, Linda, when I see that, because it's interesting that you said, like, are these people overprotected and you wonder if they are now in the 20s or something like that. But the way that you handled it, I always thought that was really good because you had these kids and I was like, I could barely, you know what I mean? All I could think about was doing work all the time. And I thought, how do you have these, not one, but two kids? And I always wondered about that. And especially now when I go, how the hell did Linda have kids in the middle of all of that? That's what I didn't figure out. Tell me about the Florida Panthers? You were going to do goalies for them? What were you going to do? Going to be the goalie there or what?
Yeah, right.
All right.
Yeah, last March, the Florida Panthers is really great, you know, promotion because they were hit so hard with injuries to not only the main two goalies, but goalies in their AHL, which is, you know, obviously the league under the NHL. And so they thought they turned it to a marketing campaign, which was brilliant. So they're going to hold a goaltender tryout, to play with the Florida Panthers now. Of course, you couldn't play in a game, a real game, but you were trying out for our chance to be a part of their practice one day. Like, actually on the ice with the Florida Panthers during one of their practices, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, I wanted to try out, and they invited me down there along with about 100 other amazing goalies. And I was happy, babe, because I wasn't, you know, I did well. I stopped 11 to 12 shots, which was great. And I was pretty good around the ice and all that. It was fun. And but the thing is, I would love the fact there were other women trying out. I met, like, these three other really cool chicks that played goal. And I was like, they were, of course, they were younger than me. And I was like, this is great. You know, and that was another part that I'm most proud of, that, you know, I played goalie since I was 14 years old and played in high school mm-hmm. with the boys on the boys team, and then played with girls for the first time when I got to college. And to see these young women who, you know, play goalie, you know, and I was like, I was just so proud of them, you know. And so it was such a complete event for me in so many ways. And I was actually on the ice last week, believe it or not. I don't want to hang them up, babe, playing at a Rangers charity, a Ranger alumni game. And I'll tell you, that was challenging, but it was fun. But, you know, it's great. So that's what that was about.
I saw something today in Forbes that said the Rangers have the most are the most expensive team. Not most expensive, but they're worth like $1 billion for the Rangers.
Most.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, they're worth the most. I think Toronto used to be the Maple Leafs, and they dropped down to 3. And I think Montreal is 2. But, man, that's what I want to be when I grow up. I want to be part of that Rangers organization.
I don't blame you. You played college. You played goalie in college, too?
Yes, on the Oswego State girls team, women's team. What a great experience. And where can you stay when you play a team like Cornell and you let up 16 goals in a game, yet you stop 65 shots, and you can say that was like your greatest game of the year? And that's what happened every year when I played Cornell, you know, type of thing. And what an experience, exactly, to play in, you know, upstate New York and play all these teams, girls' teams back in the day. And it was just fabulous. And then, but the reason why is that I was playing with boys all throughout my whole teenage life and got me well prepared and actually, you know, play like a guy, you know, mm-hmm. I go up there and, you know, do my thing. And I'll tell you, it was so great, babe. It's really part of my bloodline, that really helped me strive and become what I am, you know, today professionally, as well as a person. To have that opportunity, you know, to play with a team and play with something you love and you have passion for, and also, you know, being a goaltender, again, I had such low self-esteem, and to put myself out there and risk being, you know, the GOAT, meaning in a bad way, and then just because you have a shot to be the hero and, you mm-hmm. know, save a game. And you're no longer the wallflower when you're a goalie. You may wear a mask, but, you know, you could really stand out. And I felt it had so much more meaning to me than just playing a position in a great sport. For me, it was personal and just trying to feel good about myself and having the confidence. And that is why, to this day, you know, I don't want to let go of a lot of things that made me complete and made me grow early on in my life. Because once I let go of that stuff, what's going to be there to replace it? And, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. As we get older, we all, whatever it is, we all deal with these kind of things. Like, how do we fill that void? So, you know, it's a process. Every day I got to remind myself of that.
But don't you still play it a little now?
I'd like to play more, and yeah, I mean, I know I do my best to stay in shape just if somebody comes calling, but I really do, babe, have to make a better effort too. Yeah, like, go play in these leagues. But you know, even down in Florida, I mean, the time you get on the ice, it's like midnight. I don't
yeah.
want to be on the ice.
Right.
Midnight.
Exactly.
I want to be coming up watching my favorite TV shows on the couch or in my bed, you know, or whatever. So that's the problem, getting ice time.
Tell me.
I guess I gotta someday own a rink. Why don't we buy a rink?
Yeah, I'll do that in Florida sometime, and you can fly down. tell me about the book. Tell me about Conehead and all about it. Did you go through a big process? I mean, mine started out early, and then it just turned into like all these things that I had to say. But when you did Conehead, what was it about? Tell me about it. I mean, I know it, but you tell people about it.
Well, I wrote that book Conehead about 8 years ago because I felt I had a unique story to tell. And I've shared some of it with you right now mm-hmm. regarding how I grew up and why sports was important. And it wasn't a preachy book. It was very eye-opening to people were so amazed after they read it that I got so personal, and I really got the guard down so people can learn about me and what made me tick. And it wasn't like self-serving. It was more like to help people, other people like myself that had to deal with these things. And, you know, and I was very open about my marriage and how I met my husband and all these kind of things, and then how it didn't work out. You know, people were like so surprised at how the book ended. So it was about my love for sports, my dad and my mom and what they meant to me. And then just this journey that I had to be, you know, to do what I had to do to get to ESPN and also, you know, balance a personal life and realize, you know, that wasn't what I thought it was going to be like, and it was mostly on me, despite, you know, in spite of the love that my ex-husband had for me, and it just wasn't to be. So it's just sort of like a look at life, and but you know what? I'm glad I wrote it. I don't know if I could come up with something like that again, but you never know.
You know, one of the things that I wondered is, I always wondered why you didn't do radio after they decided to do real radio instead of putting up with me. You know what I mean? I never understood that, but you do a podcast now, but I always wondered if you were going to do radio because you like it.
I gotta be honest. They got rid of my podcast, even though it was, like, great. And I could send you some, you know, stupid excuse and say, oh, yeah, you know, I was tired of doing podcasts. No, I love doing the podcast. They didn't see it as a priority. I always loved doing radio. They didn't see me in that role. And that's part when I look back on my career at ESPN, I'm always going to be mystified about why the outside world thought I was so great at those roles and the inside world of ESPN and Bristol did not. And, you know, I'll never understand that. And no one ever gave me a straight answer. So there's your answer to that.
You know, because one of the things about it, when they put everybody on anyway, I always think, why didn't Linda do that? Because Linda has that broadcasting experience, let alone the TV. But you know how to do radio, which people don't really understand sometimes about what it does to do that, because they just assume if you're on television, you certainly can be on radio, and it's not necessarily the same thing. And I always wondered about that. You know, one of the things is that when you were first in TV and radio, somebody said to me, Linda was the first person doing an on-air, a national show. And I said, wait, I thought I was. And they said, no, Linda was. And I was like, well, I got to find this out because I thought I was the first person to do this. Are you the person that did it or was I?
I don't know. I did it in the late 80s, 87. When did you do it?
Well, I don't know. I started over there with the Numbnuts doing them in like 93 or something. But that's what I said. Okay, I didn't know if you did a national show or I did. I have to change my whole resume now because of you.
No, you don't. First of all, let's get back to something you said. By the way, that's a tremendous compliment coming from you, by the way. And I really appreciate that, babe, because you're a legend in this industry and especially in radio. And for you to say that about me and my talents and all that, I really do appreciate that. See, that's what keeps me going and know that there's something's out of my control and all I can do is be my best, you know, when I've had an opportunity to be my best and do it and be me and shine. I can't control what people think, the subjective opinions. But your opinion means a lot to me, so thanks.
But don't you, one of the things that I know, because I have you on Twitter and do all of that kind of stuff, but you're very much into those guys that are into hockey. And you could have done a lot of different things, but hockey's where you went. It was your thing. And those guys love you, and you love them. I mean, you're writing to every person that writes to you. You're very good at that because those are your guys. And there's, you know, I've always said about football and baseball, is there anybody more, like, coddled than baseball players? But in hockey, they're just regular guys.
You know, they are. Yeah. They're the best guys out there. They really are. All the major sports, they are the nicest because they carry their own bags since they were 4 years old.
Yeah.
That's what I always like to say. They just get it. They've moved away from home when they were 15, 16, you know, to play in these traveling leagues and these young junior leagues. They learned how to be self-sufficient at an early age, and they also respect women. They respect women because it's the great hockey moms that take these kids in and take them to the rinks and bring them back and make sure they have something to eat. And all
right.
These guys, for the most part, of all the sports, they respect women. And it's just that's just a couple of examples of why they're great guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I'm on Twitter at Linda Cohn and everything, I try to respond to my fans and just people who love hockey because, you know, we're all a passionate bunch, and they all get it, you know, in some capacity. Some, you know, and you know what? You just try to, you know, relate to them, and it's easy because we're all in the same boat. So yeah, that's why I like.
You know,
that's why I think hockey players are just a cut above.
I have to tell you, one time I talked to Gretzky, and when I talked to him, we had this really nice conversation, and then he proceeded to tell me that they had to take him, whatever, his parents. But he was 14 years old when he had to go to these junior hockey things, and he had to leave home. And he started telling me, and we started talking to him about this, and he talked about how he cried at night because he was really scared. It was unbelievable when he told me this. And I sat there like a dumbass talking to him, you know. And it was like he was so, you could just see him going back there. And here's this great guy talking about when he was 14 years old. And he said, I used to cry every night. I never let them know. And I was like, oh, my God, you know, because they took him because he was so good. But he was still so young.
And this is what I'm saying to you. They had to learn to live on their own and live with strangers in order to excel in the sport they were meant to excel at. And plus, they are so real. And here is an example of that, the great one, opening up his heart and telling you how he was sobbing when he was 14 each and every night.
You know, one of the things I was talking about, Linda, was that somebody asked me this, and I said, you know, mostly I covered football and baseball most of the time, and I never had a black person be rude to me in any way because they kind of, and again, we're talking 80s and 90s, and I think they looked at me like, you didn't get in here by stepping over people. Do you know what I mean? They understood that. And they were never nasty and ugly or anything to me. I mean, you know, and it's not black, white kind of thing, but I'm just saying that I never had anyone be an a-hole to me in any way because I think they know that what we had to do was unlike what other people had to do to get into a locker room.
And that's, to me, one of the values that I felt and one of the advantages for me personally of working at ESPN, the National Network. Because when I did go out and cover the NFL or Major League Baseball or the NBA, they felt, these players that would meet for the first time, felt like they already knew me.
Mm-hmm.
And I earned their respect of the job I did on television each and every night on SportsCenter. So they knew I wasn't faking it. They knew I wasn't in sports just to be someday on Entertainment Tonight. They knew I had a passion for what they do, and they also knew I had a respect for the professional athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is why, you know, what you put out there, it comes back. And that's how it was with you and continues to be with you, babe, because people know that you didn't, you know, just whatever to get there, that you really worked hard, and that's what I was hoping, and that was the result. That's why it felt so good. Like when I would meet these guys for the first time, I was so excited to meet them, and they already trusted me and liked me because of what they saw on TV.
Tell everybody what you did on the Stanley Cup when they won it all a few years ago. Go ahead and tell them what you did. No one else ever did that.
Oh, well, when my Rangers finally won the Stanley Cup in 1994?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. It was a magical night. It was in my top five amazing nights of how everything came together. A, first of all, I wasn't even going to be sure I was going to be in the building. It was Game 7, Stanley Cup final. I never asked anybody at work for anything. That's another thing I'm very proud of. And then I said, finally, obviously, it was the hottest ticket in New York City. I mean, in God knows how many years of any sport, forget sports, in general, this is a team that hadn't won the Cup since 1940, and they were one win away. And so the guy that was running the hockey, our hockey stuff at ESPN, I said, listen, I said, just get me in the building. Get me a press pass. I got to be in the building for Game 7. I paid for the ticket in game five. I was actually a fan. They didn't get the job done. So game seven, was not prepared, couldn't get a ticket. He got me a press pass. And back then it was easier to suddenly just get press passes. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously since 9/11 everything changed with sports and everything. But anyway, so I'm in the building. They win the Stanley Cup. Of course, it was pins and needles because the game, final was 3-2, and there was a face-off in the Rangers' end with 1.3 seconds left, and everybody, all Ranger fans were convinced that Vancouver was going to tie up the game and send it to overtime, but thank God it didn't happen. So then I call my dad, which was very emotional for me. He was in Florida. I don't know. He was kind of near you, actually. He was in Florida. And then a friend of mine, her name is Georgie, I said, we have to find out where the Rangers are having this party. She found out it was downstairs in the Madison Square Garden, this private area. The guy at the door was a guy who still works for NBC, Bruce Beck. He just happened to be hanging out at the door. I said, Bruce, I got to get in there. He somehow got me in. If that wasn't enough, babe, there's all the Rangers celebrating a Stanley Cup victory. Then I see the Stanley Cup. It's cornered off by rope. You would think, you know, it's its own VIP section. So people are under the rope. I somehow, as I always say, I did it. Somehow I snuck under the rope. I drank from the Stanley Cup, and someone took a picture of it.
And it's the best ever. Everyone will always know that because you drank from the Stanley Cup.
Right. The night they won, hours before they won the Stanley Cup. God knows what I was drinking. It was champagne with some, I don't even know. But it didn't matter, babe. It did not matter. So, yeah, that ranks right up there with the birth of my two children.
That's so funny because I just think it was such a good thing. And it was like, wouldn't everybody want to do exactly what you did there?
Yeah, that's why it was a perfect night.
It was the perfect night.
Perfect night.
Let me ask you something. How long do you think you'll be working there, and what will you do afterwards? Or do you have time to do anything afterwards? You know, all of a sudden I was like, somebody called me up and said, do you want to do this podcast? And I said, yeah, I don't want to work all the time. But he said, well, we can do this. And I was like, well, I don't want to go to work or anything like that. And he said, well, we can do this and you can do this podcast. And I'm like, I don't think, you know, I think like three people listen to the podcast, but I don't know. But you know what? It's like, I like to do it. It's fine. And we're getting it done. But I think to myself, you do your sports center all the time. So what are you going to do? Is there a time when you say, I'm not going to do this, or I am going to do this, or what will you do with it?
Well, here's the thing. Oh, definitely. I mean, I don't know, maybe a few more years of sports center. I mean, that's what my contract says, you know, three more years. But I really want to kind of do, I would love to get back on radio. I would love to host a hockey show on radio. I would love to do TV if they still want me. And I'd love to work for the New York Rangers in any capacity. So that's what I feel. I still have a lot to give. I also like to help young people. I feel like I also can be a consultant for professional athletes and help them with many of their challenges, whether it's in the media or just in life and in balance. And I just want to help people. So I think there's a balance there. But there's no way I'm playing. And, of course, I'd love to figure out how to keep playing hockey, you know, once every blue moon.
I get to see you when you're 80 and I'm going to find you. And I'm like, Linda, you're still playing and you're 80. How about it? You know, I have a feeling you will, though. You've done it forever. Go on. Go on.
Thank you, babe. Thanks. I just might. I know what else I'll be doing when I'm 80. I'll definitely have season tickets to the Rangers. I'll be the one sitting up there cheering them on, you know. So, I don't know. I just love that. So, I think the message is, and you know this, and this is why you're doing this podcast, because you're so good with people. You're so good interviewing people and talking to people. The thing is, that's the key. Just continue to do things that make you happy.
And, you know, I find out, too, that some people don't really get, like, when I sit down, I know when I'm talking to you, I know. But the whole time we're writing, there'll be little things that I might write in and ask you about it. But it's different. Some people are afraid to be on the radio. They're afraid to be even on. I mean, I look at people sometimes and I see them on television. And I think to myself, God forbid if you should ask them a question that doesn't go off the script. You know?
Yeah, right. Right. Well, yeah, well, that's what I mean. That's what I mean. And I'm like, that's not me. And I see what TV and certain networks have become, including ESPN. And I'm like, you know what? People change and things change. And I'm not going to conform, you know. I've never been one to conform. You know, one of my favorite sayings, and as we get older, we're all into the inspirational saying, and I've been for over a decade now, and it's like, you know, we spend so much time trying to fit in, and we're meant to stand out. And that's me. I'm done with trying to conform mm-hmm. and fit in. Sure, you have to pay the bills, so you have to, you know, talk about perhaps some things in sports or, you know, certain sports in general you can care about or it's not interesting to you, but, you know, you have to pay the bills. But there's a time where I have to be myself, so that's why it's going to be easy for me to walk away.
Now, let me ask you, because I asked you this before, but we'll do it separately because we're doing the stupid podcast. But are people coming to your house? Because I said, you know, somebody's got me vegan something, and I hate these people right now. So what's going on at your house for Thanksgiving? Because I got this pumpkin soup that I want to kill these vegan people with. So what's going on at your house?
I have to say to you, I'm not that I'm vegan, but you're going to be shocked. I hope you're sitting down. Not only am I having 20 people over my home, the best part of that is they're all my family. The second best part of that is I'm not cooking a single thing.
Thank God.
Is that happening? My brother-in-law is a chef. I said, listen, I will buy everything you need. Just cook it.
Yeah.
And so he's coming over early, and he's doing so. And here's the kicker. I said, can you make everything gluten and dairy free and have an organic turkey? He said, Linda, that's going to cost you a fortune. I said, I know, but most of my family, including myself, when I'm a good girl, even on Thanksgiving, I'm gluten and dairy free because you know what happens, babe? If I'm not, I'll get a big tummy ache. So this is what I'm doing. So your vegan friends would love to come over to my house. Let me tell you.
I should send them to Connecticut. I should send them to Connecticut, but I'm so over this, as I'm making this other thing, and I'm making like a curried pumpkin soup, but I got to put almond milk and coconut milk, and I'm going, can I just put cream and chicken in this one over here? No, you have to make it for this. And I said, I will never do this again, ever.
You're crazy.
I love you, Linda. I love you. And can we talk sometime, anytime? I love it, and I thank you very much because I think it's important for people to hear what we do sometimes, all right?
Sometimes, all the time. And thank you again, Dave. I just love that we're friends, and I love you.
Okay, that was great talking to Linda. I have known her for such a long time. It's really great to touch base with her whenever I can. You know what we're going to do? We're going to talk to Robert Littell. He's pretty good. I'm going to call him Rob, but he's from Black Sports Online and some very good information. We talked about Missouri, and then we started talking about Ferguson, and then we started talking about Cam Newton. It was very interesting. I love talking with him. How are you?
I am doing well. I'm, you know, happy almost holidays are here. I don't like the winter weather, but I do like the winter holidays.
Are you in St. Louis? Is that where you are?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, you know, I don't want to say anything, but I went with some friends of mine up to like an hour outside of St. Louis, and I thought, what am I doing up here in the middle of December? It was cold, and I didn't like it at all. So was it not a good thing for me to go up in the middle of nowhere? What is it, where they have the wine country?
Yeah. Anything like, you know, St. Louis is kind of like a little circle. So, like, anytime you go outside of the circle, you're pretty much in the middle of nowhere.
Now, tell me this. What are you doing for Thanksgiving? Do you have plans to go, like, around the planet? Are you going to somebody's house? What are you doing?
Yeah, so what I do on Thanksgiving is very similar to what I do on Christmas. I stop by family members' houses that I haven't seen, you know, pretty much all year.
And then you
eat. I have to check in on my grandmother. I have a stepbrother that I don't see a lot. I always try to check in on him. And then what I do is I try to get all of that done in the morning. And then I come back home and then people, you know, bring me food while I watch football.
Oh, I might want to go to your house. I'm having a big trouble. I mean, the big trouble is that I was just making a curried pumpkin soup and now I found out that there are vegans in this damn curried pumpkin soup. And I'm like, why do... And they said, no, you got to make it for the vegans because you have to give them coconut milk and all that. And I'm like, Rob, I hate these people more than... Don't ever come to my house, ever. And I'm not... It's not even at my house. It's somebody else's house. But I hate it. You don't do that, right? There's no gluten nonsense at your house, is there?
Oh, no, no, I'm too old for that. It's like, you know, the fatter and more calories, the better. And it's funny because I have some vegan friends, and I'm like, so you guys are, you know, vegetarians? And they're like, no, it's totally different, right. Totally different. And I'm like, this is too confusing for me. I'm going to eat this chicken, and you guys can choose to eat it or not, but I'm going to eat this chicken and cherry pie, and exactly. I'm going to have a bunch of soda. And if you guys just want to eat whatever that is on the, you know, that you brought, that's fine.
tell me a little bit about Black Sports Online, because you're kind of involved with Fox as well, too.
Yeah, so, you know, Black Sports Online kind of came about out of necessity. I went to college at The Ohio State University, and I have
love
a
you.
Degree
Did you
in
know
journalism.
That, first of all, do you know that I love you? Because I'm so in love with Ohio State. I wish I could tell you I went there, but I have Ohio State flags and act like I went there. But please, go ahead, Rob. Don't listen to me. Go ahead.
Hey, that's okay. We accept all Buckeyes, you know, even if you didn't go there or not.
Even though we know what happened last weekend.
Yeah, that was sad. But we got a championship last year, so nobody's complaining that much. But after college, I tried to go the traditional route in the media, you know, newspaper, radio, you know, stuff like that. But it wasn't working out too well for me. And I'll be honest with you, I don't think I was as mature, prepared to really work as hard as I needed to get into those industries after college. So what I did was that while I was working kind of, you know, these odd jobs here and there, to kind of sharpen my skills and keep, you know, using my degree for something, you know, I started this, you know, website, almost 11 years ago, you know, before, you know, social media and all of that stuff, but as a way to, you know, to have an outlet, you know, to talk about, you know, sports. And one of the things that I wanted to do is back then, there wasn't a lot of minorities in online mm-hmm. media. There wasn't a lot of women and things like that. There definitely wasn't a lot of black media members in the online world. So I wanted to have a place to where kind of a safe haven for those who maybe haven't, you know, had an opportunity to be in media. It's very hard to get into. And, you know, that was kind of the original idea behind it. And it's kind of blossomed over the years, thankfully, because, you know, technology has improved and everybody gets their information on the internet now. And it's kind of blossomed into this, you know, space where we have a lot of minority writers, a lot of women writers. We give kind of a different perspective. We talk about sports and sports entertainment. And, you know, it's really become like a godsend, you know, for me, kind of changed my life. I've kind of grew up, you know, in the same time that I've been running the site, and you know, this is where we're, you know, kind of at, you know, right now, you know, fairly, you know, popular, fairly mainstream now, but still has that feel of, you know, we're here for the people, we're here to make sure that, you know, we give you something that you're not going to get every day from the mainstream media.
You know, one of the things about it is that when you are, I'm going to be a journalist, I'm going to do this, but I thought it was interesting when you said, I don't know if I worked hard enough to prepare for the other kind of things, because 11 years ago, everybody was losing a job like crazy, and now, I guess if you have a job, let's say at a newspaper, you have to do Twitter and Facebook, and then you get around to writing your newspaper, where it was always the paper, mm-hmm. and now it's like the third thing.
And, you know, I think in retrospect, that's kind of what helped me out a lot, because while, you know, back then, you know, in my early 20s, I was, you know, maybe lazy about, you know, certain things. When it came to, you know, computers and the internet, I was really up on it. I kind of, you know, I was on the internet, you know, and doing things and using social avenues to promote and, you know, speak about certain topics. Well before it became like popular. So by the time that it did become popular and everybody was mm-hmm. doing it, I had maybe a better understanding and a greater depth of how to use social media, how to use technology, how to use, you know, forms and how to get your message out, how to get your stories out before, you know, kind of whereas, you know, I think others kind of, you know, especially if they had been in media and they were kind of old school traditional media, they were kind of learning on the fly mm-hmm. where I, you know, kind of grew up, you know, in this online, you know, world and is very comfortable and familiar, you know, with me at a young age. And I think that really helped out our site a lot.
Rob, talk to me about the University of Missouri. You have this Black Sports Online. You're just an hour and a half or whatever it is to go to Columbia. Explain to me, because I was, you know, I sort of saw it, and then all of a sudden it got a little bitter, and then this guy's resigning. The other guy's going to resign. Gary Pinkel says, I'm with my guys. And I said, I have to look a little farther into this. So I did, but I sort of wanted to know, how was it for you when you did it? Because it's one of those things where I guess the racial injustice was one of it, but the other thing was the First Amendment, too.
Right. It was the type of situation that I found interesting, only because I live here. I've heard about these things going on at the University of Missouri for a long time, you know, 6 months, a year, even going farther back than that, you know, because it didn't have a, you know, a sports element to it. You know, we didn't, you know, write about it or talk about it much, but on a local level, it's something that's been out there, you know, for a pretty long time, that there's a serious, you know, racial divide on that campus. And it's funny that you mentioned, you know, kind of being out in the middle of nowhere. And it's kind of the same, you know, situation is that, you know, out in Columbia, there is a lot of the kids that go to Missouri come from these rural towns, rural cities in Missouri where, you know, they're not around a lot of minorities or a lot of Black people. And a lot of the Black kids that do go to Missouri are from Kansas City or St. Louis. So they're from like cities, you know, you know, bigger cities. And I think there's a culture issue there where you have city, you know, urban city kids with rural, you know, white kids, and, you know, it's not meshing. And there was a situation where I think they felt that the university in and of itself didn't care about the situation, just kind of felt like this was something that happens on all campuses. And it really didn't get any attention until, you know, football players got involved with it. And I think that kind of tells you the power of sports, that a situation that was out there for a year, year and a half, you know, pretty much gets no traction. The president wasn't going to, you know, resign or anything. And then as soon as, you know, football players get involved, within 48 hours, he's gone. Oh, he's resigning and other things are happening. And I think, you know, it was kind of twofold. You know, I'm glad that it came to light from a national level, but it also tells you that a lot of times, unless something major or someone major gets involved, a lot of these issues are kind of swept under the rug.
Well, and one of the things is when I saw it, you know, I mean, they had a parade and the president was in it and he's going along and they just sort of supposedly actually bumped somebody when they were trying to get around in the parade. And then it just seemed to escalate to a point where I was like, obviously, something's been going on there. And then when I heard about the person who was, I think he was African American and gay. And so it was all kinds of Africa. It was, you know, Black and gay, the whole thing over and over to him to be the president. And I thought, you know, you sort of think, oh, Missouri, it's up there. You don't really, you know, you're thinking, oh, did we hear this at LSU? Did we hear this at Florida? But Is it just that they just ignored them and said, forget it, or did they realize that something had to be done here?
No, I think I think the frustration was it was being ignored, or it was being like, you guys should, you know, settle this on your own, or this is, you know, it was hard maybe for the president and some of the upper level administration to even admit to themselves that some of this thing, you know, some of these things were happening. And I noticed that a lot in society is that it's not necessarily that people are racist or prejudiced or anything like that. It's more of an ignorance. Like, they can't believe, you know, that a police officer would just, you know, shoot somebody or shoot a Black person, you know, randomly. They won't believe that a Black person, you know, just are not getting a job because of the color of their skin or their name or whatever. They don't believe that, you know, some of these arrests that are happening are really false. You know, it's because they're so far away from it that, you know, and they've been taught a certain way that they just don't believe these types of things are happening. And I think at Missouri, I think what was happening was they were being told, but they just didn't think that their university was happening. And it took a national it to become a national story for, you know, actual action to happen. Now, the question that I always have is that, okay, you got the president out, you got, you know, all of this attention. you know, what is going to be done now? Because a lot of times we're in a society where, you know, we get one thing done, and then we, you know, somebody, we move on to something else, and then the bigger problem never gets solved.
Do you think that the fact that Paris happened and changed everybody's feeling of everything, and that was sort of put away now, although it was the big story, but it, since Paris came along, it made all the difference in the world that that's the thing that we're talking about, and they've kind of swept it under the rug, but it's on the back burner now, not where we are when it comes to 24-hour news cycles, because that was a big deal until Paris happened.
Right, and that's the thing is, like, it's almost sometimes like it's a catch 22. You know, do you live in, you know, fear, you know, 24/7, or do you, you know, ignore, you know, what's going on around you and realize, you know, this is serious threat. You know, it doesn't matter where you're at, what part of the country you're at. I mean, Paris is a pretty much a not a crime filled, you know, country and pretty docile and civil. And we could see what happens there. You know, you can get on a plane, you can get on a bus, a train, you can go to a sporting event, and anything, you know, could happen. And it's scary. And we have so many internal issues within our country, and then we're dealing with the external issues of people, you know, trying to take us down. You would think that would make us want to come together as a country, because we have much, you know, bigger problems than the problems, you know, that we have with ourselves, especially with these outside external, you know, terrorists that don't care about white, black, religion. They just want to destroy everybody. So you would hope that would make us want to come together more.
Talk to me a little bit about the fact that Gary Pinkel went on the side of his people, which his football players, I got, and then like the next day he said, and I'm leaving because I have cancer. So I didn't quite get that. I mean, I hope that you're better. I'm a person that had breast cancer. I hope that you're fine. But it just seemed odd that he said, and by the way, I'm leaving after here. That was all kind of odd. Yeah. Maybe I was just wrong.
Yeah, it was weird timing. You would think that maybe that's something that you would, you know, maybe say after the season or, you know, in the off season, after, you know, some of this had died down. It was just odd that it came like right on the cusp of that. I don't know if he wanted to make sure he got the proper, you know, farewell. You know, it's really hard to say because, I mean, at first a lot of people was wondering, was he just, you know, making it up? I mean, he had to actually show some medical records, you know, for the people that, like, you know, this seems kind of odd. Are you just trying to get out of Dodge of everything that's going on? You know, I don't know if this was kind of pre-planned and he just, you know, said, hey, I can't change it. I already decided to announce it. But it was really strange, you know, timing. And it's you wonder, you know, what people say publicly about support and what they really feel, you know, privately. And I guess we won't ever know privately, you know, how he really felt about that situation.
Well, I just thought, and I think you're right, probably afterwards, but if he had it and he was going to say it, it was just kind of odd the way everything was going down in every way. Can I just stop for a minute? I just want to do this. You did something about, is Cam Newton a thug? What was the reaction to that? Did you see him in that way? Did other people say, yes, he's a thug or he's not? I don't see him in that way, but other people may or may not. How did you see that?
No, you know, the question I was posing, it was slightly sarcastic, and a bit rhetorical. The point was, you know, if you see Cam Newton as a thug, you know, what do you think about just, you know, regular, everyday, you know, black men in society? And what my point was is, like, if there are people out there, and there are more than a few that are out there that see Cam Newton, who's a guy that is just playing football, a millionaire who likes to dance and smile a lot, that gives a lot back to the community and the kids. If there's a portion of society that thinks that guy is thug, is a, you know, which basically is branding him as some sort of, you know, criminal. Imagine what they think about, you know, me if I'm just, you know, walking in the mall or walking down the street, or, you know, what do they think about the guy with the braids or the guy with the black guy with tattoos? It was more trying to open people's eyes to the struggle that as black men, you know, we deal with in a society on a daily basis, that everything that we do, everything that we say, how we walk, what we wear, how we dress, all of that is has such negative stereotypes, to the point that an NFL quarterback dancing in the end zone is seen as some sort of criminal. And until we kind of eliminate these type of stereotypes, it's going to be very difficult, especially for minorities, to have a trusting relationship with anyone in society. And I tell people this all the time. I don't have any problem with anybody. But when you're that paranoid about what people think about you, it makes you wonder about everybody that you meet. I talk to someone, say I'm in a meeting, or I meet someone at an event and they just happen to be, white. And we can have the greatest conversation of all time. We can talk about sports. We can talk about family, our kids, or whatever. There's still that little thing in the back of your head mm-hmm. when you walk away that you say, I wonder what he really, thinks about me. What does he really think about black people? That's sad that that's there, but history shows we have a reason, basically to be paranoid about this. And that's kind of what I wanted to bring to light in that article.
One of the things I always think of myself, I lived in Boston, I lived in New York, I'm somewhat street smart and all that. And the reality, Rob, is that I'm really just a white chick from the suburbs. And I think I really am just a white chick that grew up not particularly wealthy, but not poor by any means. And I just thought that's really who I am. And I always think, well, I lived in the city and I know, and maybe I don't know squat. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The thing that you don't want to do is you don't want to stereotype, other people.
Right.
But that's the weird thing about it is that if you get stereotyped so much, your automatic reaction is to stereotype others. Well, he thinks I'm this, so I'm going to think, badly, of him. I had to learn really to, take everybody, try to see the positive in people, not assume the worst about people. And it to me, if you're white, there's nothing to be ashamed of. You don't have to say you're sorry for things that other white people, do. But it's just to try to be, understanding of the paranoia and not just kind of, try to brush things under the rug. You hear a lot of things like, why are you always bringing race into it, or you're playing the race card, mm-hmm. or it's always about this and that. But without actually understanding, why people, feel that way. And, I like to think, and I know this to be true. I think the majority of people in the world, or at least in our country, are not bad, right. people. 90% are probably, cool, people. But it's that 10%, that are so vocal in their hate, in their prejudice, in their stereotypes, it makes everybody else look bad. And one of the analogies that I use is this, is that when a black person does something wrong, or criminal or whatever it may be, it affects all black people. It's like everybody looks at the next black person with a suspicious eye. Whereas if a white person does something, shoot up a theater or does a terrorist act or whatever, it has no effect on the white people as a whole. And I think that's what, at least for me as a black person, that's all, I really want is that to be treated as an individual, like, because such and such sold drugs or such and such committed a murder, that doesn't mean that I'm a bad person as well, not to be grouped in and to be seen as equals and individuals. Like, we don't want anything special. We just want it to be treated the same as everybody else.
When I think, you're in St. Louis, so let me go a bit to Ferguson. I started watching CNN and I was watching it. And then when they put the flowers, where he was, and I just the whole thing. And then as you watched it, and it was just so much rage inside that people just had to get rid of. And I understand that. How many times was he shot? Like 6 times? I think in Michael Brown, and that, something like that. And it was like the rage inside it. And I said, I can sort of see that rage, even though I'm across, the country watching what's going on. But it was just a matter of, do you see that just people have just had it and that's it? And people are just standing up and saying, you're not going to do this anymore. Wasn't there a kid recently in St. Louis that just got hit like 16 times or some ridiculous thing?
Yeah.
Yes, wasn't it? Right. And I just, how do you... how do you even, A, shoot anybody 16 times, and B, can you not shoot them in the foot? I mean, you know, I don't really know that much about guns, and it's probably better, Rob, that I don't. Do you know what I mean? But can you not shoot somebody in the leg, or do you have to shoot them 15 times? I don't understand this.
Well, here's the thing, and a lot of people don't understand this because, like I said, they don't experience it. And in 2015, things that you would have never heard about 10 years ago, 20 years ago, are national, you know, stories. You know, stuff that happened, you know, I grew up here, you know, and where I grew up originally was not, you know, the best part, you know, of town. So things that were happening, like Ferguson, has happened here in St. Louis, and I'm assuming it's happened in other cities like St. Louis, for a very long time. Like, that wasn't surprising to me. I wasn't shocked by what happened because I've known this to happen, you know, for pretty much all of my life. You know, the only difference is now, because of social media, because of everybody having cameras and things like that, these stories that used to be kind of local stories that people would get away with are now national stories, and people are having answers. And people like yourself, mm-hmm. who maybe would have never known about anything like this happening, or if they did find out about it happening, it would have been so much of a cover-up, you wouldn't even think of asking any questions, because, you know, the police would just say, oh, he did X, Y, and Z, so we shot him, and people would say, okay, you're the police, why would you lie? But now we have people that are exposing those lies, and mm-hmm. now we're getting people asking questions. You know, did you really need to shoot somebody, you know, 20 times? You know, if this person wasn't armed, why didn't you use a taser? You know, why is all these things happening? And that's good that people are asking questions, because now people are starting to see what has been happening for a very long time. You know, police brutality and police injustice didn't just pop up overnight. Mm-hmm. I mean, these has been happening for a very long period of time, and they've been getting away with it. And that's why it continued to happen. So now, slowly but surely, even though some are still getting away with it, enough, I think, are getting punished or at least mm-hmm. embarrassed and brought to light that hopefully it would stop, you know, it would curtail some of this illegal activity that's happening from the cops.
You know, I said St. Louis, and I was talking about Laquan McDonald, who's the guy that was shot mm-hmm. 16 times in Chicago. I just wanted to correct myself on that. And I mean, like, we go to the same thing. You're 17 years old, and you've got to shoot him 16 times. I mean, at some point, I think three is enough. And it just, it's interesting, too, because, like I said, I think maybe I'm more aware than some people because I understand more of what's going on with black people, American African-American, however you want to use that, because I like the word black. Am I right or wrong in that, Rob? Help me.
I mean, it's, you know, black, African-American.
But some people don't want to be called African-American.
Yeah, you know, I'm not, you know, to be honest with you, I'm not big on African-American myself. The reason mm-hmm. being is, you know, I was born in America, you know.
Right.
And I say that because, you know, people don't go around saying they're English American or they're French American or they're Italian American. They're, you know, they're just, you know, Italian or white or, you know, whatever they are, you know, they're French, you know, Chinese, Asian, you know, people don't add that extra American, you mm-hmm. know, to it. So why do we have to add that? I mean, most people that were, you know, that black people that live in America were born here. You know, I have never been to Africa. I know my roots are from Africa, but those roots go pretty far back, you know, before that. You know, most of all of my immediate family are all from American, so I just see myself as an American. Now, I understand that you have to identify as something in America, but, you know, for me, I'm black, I live in America, but I'm an American, so I don't feel like a need, you know, because white people don't say that they're British American,
right.
Because it's not like we, I mean, everybody that came to America came from somewhere else. You know, the only people that really have the right to say that they're like true Americans are the Indians, and you see what happened to them. So I know some people don't like African American. It doesn't bother me either way, but I prefer black only because, like I said, you know, I feel like I'm
exactly.
I don't have to say that I'm any different American than anybody, you know, else.
I love talking to you, Rob. Can we talk again sometime? Because this was great. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for joining me today.
No problem at all. Anytime, you know, just let me know. I think these are good discussions to have, and I'm glad that you have a podcast out there to get those discussions out there, because the more people that we have talking, that's the only way that things can get better.
You know what? That was a pretty good podcast. I have to give it to you. Even if I liked it, I think you should like it just as well. You know what? We'll talk to more people, but I hope you have a good Thanksgiving. If you're listening to this after Thanksgiving, I hope you had a really good Thanksgiving. I got to make vegan crap that's making me crazy. But I am the Fabulous Sports Babe.
If you know the babe at all, you know the show never ends.
Don't believe me, just watch.
Follow her on Twitter at RealSportsBabe and subscribe to the show on iTunes. This is the Fabulous Sports Babe on Radio Influence.
Hey, sports fans, this is Rich Scherrer. Make sure to tune in to my brand new podcast. It's called Off the Air. We sit down with the biggest names in sports broadcasting, the guys that bring you all the big plays. We're going to turn the microphone off and get to know them off the air. It's Off the Air with Rich Scherrer. Don't forget, you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and, of course, RadioInfluence.com is our home on the World Wide Web. So make sure to tell all your friends about Off the Air with Rich Scherrer, a weekly podcast featuring the biggest names in broadcasting.